Last night, Iowans gathered for caucuses, not to weigh in on party nominations for president, but to determine who will control the parties. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last night's caucuses didn't come with the bright media limelight of presidential year caucuses, but both Republicans and Democrats gathered in their neighborhoods for precinct meetings. It's the first step in a multi-step process that leads to the selection of state party leaders and the honing of the party's belief statements. This hour, we'll look at what's at stake for each party. Our analysts, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Politics Day on River to River starts right after this news. From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Did you take part in the caucuses last night? What? Caucuses last night? I thought that's 2016. No, there were caucuses last night. We want to reach out to you this hour. If you did attend a caucus, take part in your party's caucus, what did you get from that experience? What topics was the room buzzing about? And it's Politics Wednesday joining us with their analysis of the caucuses last night, what function they perform. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
And Dennis Goldford, Professor of Politics at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Dennis.
Good afternoon.
Let's start off. I know both of you, Dennis, you and Tim, were both at caucus sites last night, weren't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so before we share, have you share a little bit about your respective experiences? Dennis, you wrote the book on caucuses, so to speak. Your book you wrote from a few years ago, The Iowa Precinct Caucuses, Making of a Media Event. Tell us, when it's not about a presidential nomination, what is a caucus about?
Well, you know, in a way, the whole issue of the presidential caucuses tends to swallow the basic function of the caucuses that's always been there. The presidential dimension didn't show up until the early 1970s. Caucuses are essentially private party events. They're not run by the machinery, the electoral machinery of the state, and therefore the internal business of each political party. They're really inside baseball, even as they are democracy in one of its most classic senses. People who are interested in participating in the party show up, as those who attend, of course, know, and they deal with matters as mundane as but important as electing precinct captains, precinct officials, delegates to the countywide conventions, because as they are in a presidential year, caucuses are the first step in kind of a funnel. We go from, what is it now, something like 1,780-some-odd caucuses, the precinct caucuses, they've decreased since I've been in Iowa over all these years, the numbers decreased, to 99 county conventions, to now 4 congressional district conventions, and then to the party's single state convention in June. So they're the very beginning of that process. So people elect officials for their local precincts and county organizations. They elect delegates to the county campaigns, and then they suggest particular planks that they would like to see go into the party platform that would be discussed and debated and ratified or not in the June convention.
Tim Hagel, you were at a caucus site in Iowa City at a local precinct, mm-hmm. a GOP caucus?
Right.
Uh-huh. What did you experience? What was going on there?
Well, I actually was a fill-in chair for a neighboring precinct, so I wasn't even in my own precinct, unfortunately. And we didn't have particularly high turnout. The precinct didn't have a lot of Republicans in it to start with. The weather was like 0 degrees or something with a wind chill below that. So at least at ours, because it was a single precinct caucus, we didn't have a high turnout. But basically we had, as Dennis was saying, we went through the process. And, of course, there are forms to fill out for everything. But you basically perform 3 functions, at least the essential functions, which are to elect people to the central committee for the county, elect people to go to as delegates to the county convention, and then from there there, they could be elected to could be delegates to the district and state conventions, which for the Republicans this year is important because if the candidates running for the Republican Senate nomination don't get 35% in the primary, then it's the delegates to the state convention that will make that selection. And then the same is true if, for example, the first district Democrats don't have somebody that gets 35%, then their delegates at the district convention will also select that nominee and so forth. So it can be important, and that's why one reason why people were trying to drive turnout a little bit. But the caucuses can also do things like you sign petitions for candidates to get them on the ballot. You talk about the platform planks if people are interested in doing so. And so that's where the state, ultimately the state platform, but it starts at the precinct and so forth. So those are the kinds of things that go on. And if you have more people at your precinct, then obviously you'll have more discussions.
I'm interested in the discussions, mainly, Tim, that we've, of course, for many years been talking about the GOP having a split in between the mainstream GOP members, the social conservatives, and then also the libertarian wing. In your precinct caucus, were there any was there any sense of that struggle going on?
Of the two people that attended my caucus that
okay,
I was at.
Really, it was a very low number.
you know, but actually even there was a little bit, although the two people, one was sort of a stalwart Branstad supporter, and the other was a younger person who wasn't specifically a Rand Paul supporter, but clearly had some libertarian leanings. And so the kind of a little discussion that we were talking about, where he was also new to the caucus, so I did a lot of explaining about what's going on and what the thing is. And one of the things about this distinction between the sort of the Ron Paul supporters, libertarians, and the establishment is I think a little bit too much emphasis is placed on that particular division. That more concern I think for the Republicans to have is that the party, whether it's because of this division or otherwise, it's not in as strong a position as the Republicans would like it to be, both in terms of finances, but also in terms of simply party unity. So, I mean, regardless of whether you're, you know, more libertarian oriented or more the establishment oriented, that somehow have to come together for the good of the party as a whole. And that's, I think, what some people would like to work for and put some of the other more political divisions behind them.
Tim Hagel with us, along with Dennis Goldford, River to River listeners. Did you take part in the caucuses last night? What sense of your party did you get from that experience? What topics was the room abuzz about? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Dennis Goldford, your experience last night, where did you go?
I went to the caucuses in Clive, a suburb of Des Moines. Clive tends to be a more Republican suburb. There were Democratic caucuses and Republican caucuses, and I went because of the interest in what's going on with the Republican Party right now and the fact that the Democrats are relatively unified. And again, I went as an observer as opposed to a participant. I went to the Republican caucuses, and there were four precincts in Clive, and by my count, there were roughly around 60 people distributed across the four precincts, so not a huge number. At the very beginning, they were all in a room with terrible acoustics, and there were the temporary chair asked if people wanted to speak about anything in particular. There were people who got up and spoke for Mark Jacobs, spoke for Joni Ernst, of course, in the Iowa Republican race for the Senate nomination. One spoke for Governor Branstad, the importance of Republican turnout overall with his reelection, and hopefully he thought coattails. One person asked if people would sign a petition for Dr. Ben Carson, an African-American Republican who got some fame during the last go-round, not Herman Cain, of course, encouraging him to run for president. And then they broke into the individual precincts. And again, it was very standard kind of mechanics, election of the precinct chairs and central committee members and delegates and alternates to the county conventions, to as mundane but interestingly as important an issue of who would be willing to put a yard sign up. That's always important. And then when they got to the question of platform proposals, really it was pretty unanimous, with one interesting exception.
Now, are we talking about the Democrats or the
Republicans? No, the Republicans. Still talking about Republicans.
Okay.
Democrats had about 55 people by another count. So, again, not a huge number. They proposed a platform plank saying it's important to honor the Constitution. They wanted to add a right to keep and bear arms to the Iowa Constitution, which one young man said is not in the Iowa Constitution. Interestingly, a platform talking about a flatter fare tax, economic freedom. But the interesting areas were, first of all, the right to life plank, which is pretty standard for Republicans. When they called for the vote, this was one in which it was not unanimous. There were a couple of nays. And, of course, that's always the question for Republicans. They're firmly pro-life, anti-abortion rights, but not all Republicans subscribe to that view. And then one having to do with opposition to the Common Core standards in education and the importance of parental choice in education. And that generated some controversy as well. But I didn't see any sort of overt sign of splits between or even identification of Ron Paul libertarian folks and everybody else. I did have a gentleman come up to me afterwards saying that he remembered chairing a caucus about 20 years ago, and then he referred to, in his terms, the extreme right wing. And in his terms, he talked about how there were 16 people when he chaired his caucus 20 years ago who were religious, social and religious conservatives, and they had come in and they acted simply as a block, and every vote on every issue was 16 for them and 13 for the others, he told me. I didn't see that kind of ironclad kind of discipline with any particular faction last night.
Let's talk about how this caucus relates to the one that happens in 2 years. So if this can be broadly described as details in the party, nuts and bolts, but also who will control the party. How does who will control the party affect the hopefuls who will come from each party, national hopefuls that will come to Iowa as the first of the nation test, Tim Hagel?
Well, it's a little hard to say at this point, because normally you think of the people that go to the caucuses just in general tend to be the activists, although in presidential years you will have more people that are somewhat activists but maybe not as reliably so, that will come out and participate because of the straw poll. But a lot of the activists that are regular participants throughout the year sometimes will still not come to a midterm caucus because they don't feel it's quite as important. And even if you don't get elected to Central Committee, you can still participate in party functions and so forth. So it's a little hard to say. But as the year goes on, when we start getting to the point of the county conventions and the district conventions, and you start electing people to the state central committees, that's where you're going to start to see potentially any leadership changes. And I'm thinking in particular of the Republican Party, which has got this rift apparently. And so we'll see if that comes through. Now, as far as it affecting any 2016 presidential candidates, what they're going to be looking for are things like, well, you know, how solid is the Republican Party of Iowa?
But then again, how unified,
and but solid in terms of skill level, ability to turn out volunteers. Because what a lot of times will happen is that if the party organization, whatever the state is, Iowa or any other, if it's not strong, then the presidential candidate will have to make more of an effort to supply his or her own volunteers, which they do anyway, but sometimes those folks work well hand in hand with the state party organization, but sometimes it's a little bit rougher relationship.
Dennis Goldford, do you have anything to add to that, to the 2014 relating to 2016 question?
Well, it was very interesting. At one point last night, a woman sitting in the caucus I was observing raised her hand and said, "I just want to let people know that I just got a tweet from Rick Santorum." And she said that Rick, I guess she's on first name basis with him, Rick said hello to all my Iowa supporters, and I just want to wish you good luck in the caucuses tonight. So that was an interesting intervention by a potential candidate for 2016. But I think Tim hit the point early on, particularly with regard to the 35% rule. And who actually shows up for these various conventions is very important. You know, Woody Allen is it's famously ascribed to him the quote that he said, success in life is 80% of success in life is just showing up. And that's really the case in political events like the caucuses. And when you have people who are supportive of your positions, and they're the ones ultimately who write the state party platform, and your candidates, that because caucuses at the presidential level certainly are so much of an organizational event, even though you have this overlay of extra people coming in and participating, that core is always very important.
Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa with us on this Politics Wednesday. Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. Gentlemen, let me share this with you. Linn County Republicans gathered at the precinct, all the precincts together for last night's caucuses, and they heard from candidates and also got a challenge from Utah GOP Congressman Jason Chaffetz. Let's listen.
Please, Iowa. We have to get this right. You are such a pivotal part of our system. First in the nation. You've got a proud tradition here. But we have got to get organized, not just to defeat somebody, but to make the case that Republicans are the right people for this job, that our principles are the right thing. Now, we're a big tent. We got differing viewpoints. We got the libertarian end of the spectrum. We got the more moderates in there. Okay? You got to fight for what you believe in. We got to get this right.
Tim Hagel, what do you think Congressman Chaffetz is trying to convey in this message to Linn County Republicans?
Well, it's a couple of things. And let me start by saying that this is not Congressman Chaffetz's first trip to Iowa, that he was here during the 2012 presidential campaign on behalf of Mitt Romney. So that may have been one reason why they brought him back into this part of eastern Iowa. But, you know, one of the things that, of course, Iowa gets so much attention during the caucuses, that if you have that kind of split that we've been talking about and people have been talking about, that it can give sort of a negative impression of Iowa. And, of course, the Iowa caucuses are regularly under attack. Other states are jealous of our first in the nation status and so forth. And so aside from any kind of party reason, as Chaffetz was emphasizing, that just for the health of the caucuses, it would be good to have strong parties that are running them in an efficient way. And of course, on the Republican side, there was the counting mix-up in 2012, where initially Romney was declared the winner, and then once they got the count in, that it was a few votes put Santorum ahead. So there's that aspect to it. But then, of course, on the Republican side, that they want to have a strong party that can put on a good caucus and have it fair for all the candidates. And so if you have somebody like a Chris Christie, who is – some people say, oh, well, he wouldn't do well in Iowa. Well, we don't know that, but certainly Iowa Republicans would like to have him come in and make his case and not skip Iowa as some other candidates like John McCain and even kind of Mitt Romney in 2012.
Rudolph Giuliani did. And Rudolph Giuliani. With disastrous consequences. We like to think here in Iowa that if he's going to ignore us, he has – right? Iowans like to think that.
Exactly.
What would be getting it right in your view for the Republicans, Dennis Goldford?
Well, at one level, Chaffetz, of course, wanted to emphasize the importance of a positive, substantive message. I mean, in a nutshell, I don't know if Tim would agree or not, but you know, the basic Romney argument last time around was the economy is terrible, and I am not Barack Obama. That was the basic argument of the Romney campaign, and it didn't work very well. And a lot of Republicans since then have argued, no, there's got to be some positive program that Republicans can run on, something in detail. Of course, the more detail, the more opportunity for division and controversy there is. But they're looking for some sort of unified party approach. You know, I've told the story before, but Will Rogers is alleged to have been asked once years ago, are you a member of a political party? And he said, I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. Mm-hmm. But that's been the character of Republicans more really over the past 10 or 15 years. And you can't, you know, Obama was very lucky in not having any primary opposition. That helped him tremendously in 2012. It hurt Jimmy Carter. It hurt George Bush, you know, Bush 41 in 1992. So the idea is to find some unified party basis and expand outward from there.
For the first time, Iowa will be required to bind its delegates to the results of the GOP caucuses in the 2016 presidential race. Explain what that means, Tim, because this is not well known among Iowans, they were not bound, and in fact, they did not reflect the vote of our caucuses when they went to the convention last time, did they?
Exactly, yes. Unlike the Iowa Democrats that do bind their delegates at the caucuses, the GOP did not. And basically what happened was that you go to first your county convention, and then you go to your district convention, and that's where the process begins of selecting people who will be the delegates. And at that point, they're unbound in the sense that they may have said, well, you know, I'm a delegate, I'll vote for this person, or I'm a delegate, vote for that person, but it is totally separate from whatever the vote was at the caucuses. And in 2012, the Ron Paul supporters were very well organized. They knew exactly how the process worked. They were well trained, and they succeeded in electing a huge majority of people. I think it was 22 out of 28, something of
exactly,
that nature.
Exactly, that's the information I have, yeah.
That cast their votes at the convention. Well, of course, Ron Paul finished third place in Iowa behind Santorum and Romney, and so people say, oh, well, that's unfair. But that's the way the process worked, and at least those of us in Iowa were constantly trying to tell the media, explain to them how it worked, and that you can't put down that, you know, Santorum won, so he gets all of Iowa's delegates, because it just didn't work that way. Well, of course, that made some people unhappy that so many delegates ended up going for Paul, despite that that's the way the process worked. And so this time they're going to say, all right, well, you have to bind your delegates to something in the caucus vote. And it makes sense in a certain way, simply because if a candidate is going to come to Iowa and put all that effort into being here and running around the state and doing the grassroots organizing, they ought to have something to show for it, and that's where the delegates come in.
Before we have to take a break, give me a sense at this point, each of you, where we are 2 years out, the forces at work in each party shaping the nominating process to come. Dennis Goldford, briefly on each party, how do you see it at this point?
Well, the Democratic side is still garnering lots of talk about Hillary Clinton. When she ran and started running in 2007, at least officially, of course, she ran as the candidate of inevitability, which I've always seen as a ticket for political disaster, because you can't give any other good reason why you should get the support of people. And they're sort of talking about that again. There are questions about Biden, but I don't know how serious that is. Governor O'Malley from Maryland has expressed some interest. But, you know, the Democrats haven't done their generational shift yet the way the Republicans have. Now, of course, it's a question of what kind of support Democrats will have after the Obama term. It's hard to run, get a party to win three terms in a row. But on the Republican side, they're still trying to hash out what the direction of the party should be. Mm-hmm. And there was an argument that they should pay a lot more attention to the demographic changes. And a lot of people are saying now that the party has essentially ignored those, at least mm-hmm. the grassroots has.
Tim Hagel, briefly, before we have to take a break, of the three factions we've identified in the GOP, which is the most electable once you pass the in a general election rather than in a nomination or a caucus, an Iowa caucus? Is it the mainstream?
Well, I'm not sure that the divisions are as strong as what some people would lead you to believe, that particularly here in Iowa, there's a lot of overlap between, say, the what's considered the establishment. I always hate that phrase, but I can't think of anything better. But mainstream versus social conservatives versus libertarian, that there's a lot of overlap between those groups. The question is can they get along on some of the issues where they disagree? And again, as Chaffetz was saying, you want to have that big tent and understand that, well, okay, we may not agree on everything, but have to come together for the party. And Democrats make the same argument too at times when they've had certain divisions within their party. So this is nothing new. But at this point, we just kind of have to wait and see what the Republicans are going to do. There are a lot of, as Dennis was saying, a lot of candidates that are out there and sort of see which direction they're willing to go when it comes time for the candidates to be more serious about campaigning.
Certainly a darling of the GOP when it comes to 2016 up to, well, the last few weeks, with the exception of still is a darling of the party, I suppose. Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey. We'll talk about him when we come back at the view from Tim Hagel and Dennis Goldford about the damage having been done, continuing to be done by the controversies that surround him, what's being called Bridgegate and other controversies. We'd like to have you join our conversation as well. Politics Day on River to River, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Send us a message or question on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, my guest, one of my guests, will be broadcast journalist Soledad O'Brien. She is in Iowa for a lecture on diversity, also on TV, behind the scenes, and in our lives, diversity in our media. Tomorrow on the program, broadcast journalist Soledad O'Brien. And today, Politics Day, we're chewing over the caucuses last night. The ones that we've been talking about do not have to do with nominating the president. That comes, presidential nominations from each party, that comes in 2 years' time. But we're talking about what people who participated were up to last night. You'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We want to move on to, as we tie 2014, the caucuses, to the upcoming caucuses in 2016 and presidential hopefuls in that will be an open seat for president, no incumbent after 8 years of Barack Obama, we expect. Let's talk about Chris Christie as one of the darlings of the GOP and the controversies he's embroiled in. To get us up to speed on that, the U.S. Attorney, the Senate, even the FBI have launched investigations into the closing of two lanes of the George Washington Bridge back in September over the course of 4 days, snarling traffic, as you can imagine, over the busiest, what's been recognized as the busiest bridge in the world. 17 allies of Christie, plus the governor's office and his 2013 reelection campaign, have until February 3rd to hand over documents relating to what is apparently a politically motivated closing of access lanes to that bridge. Four Christie associates have resigned, have been fired, or had their ties to the governor cut. Also, that's just controversy number one. Controversy number two, two top officials in the Christie administration flatly denying an assertion by the mayor of Hoboken that the administration withheld Hurricane Sandy money because the mayor would not support a real estate project favored by the governor. The Christie team has chalked this up to politics, Democratic mayors with an axe to grind coming out of the woodwork. Controversy three, the Department of Housing and Urban Development auditing a $25 million sum that the state spent after Hurricane Sandy to promote tourism and the Jersey Shore, including ads that prominently featured Christie while he was running for reelection. He was reelected by a landslide. Now, in an appearance on CNN's Crossfire this week, former Virginia Attorney General and failed gubernatorial candidate Ken Cuccinelli called on New Jersey Governor Chris Christie to step down from his role leading the Republican Governors Association. Let's listen.
I think just from the perspective of setting aside this as an issue in other races, it makes sense for him to step aside in that role. He does not serve the goals of that organization by staying as chairman.
Let me ask you, that doesn't mean
any of the charges, political or otherwise, are substantive or not. It doesn't matter. Perception is reality.
Well, the goal of that organization is elected. About Chris Christie this whole time. It's all about Chris Christie. It's a party of one. Why would a Chris Christie who cares about Republicans, who cares about people like yourself who are running for office, why wouldn't he step down? Why do you think he's not stepping down?
Well, frankly, I think this is still relatively new. And he may well step down. I have no idea what his thinking is on that. And he may get some counsel from some other governors along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Goldford, is Ken Cuccinelli right?
Well, there's no love lost toward Chris Christie with regard to Cuccinelli, because Christie wouldn't campaign for Cuccinelli in his race in Virginia. There's been an argument that too much has been about Chris Christie. He was criticized roundly when he gave his speech supposedly supporting Romney at the Republican convention, and it struck people as being more about Chris Christie than Governor Romney, which added to their dismay at his seeming to get along swimmingly with President Obama when the president went into New Jersey after Hurricane Sandy. But Chris Christie, he's referred to as moderate, and you know, you use the term the darling of the GOP. I'm not sure a lot of GOP members would go that far. If you look at his particular issue positions, he's not that different from a lot of the conservatives, except possibly from some of the libertarian types, because Christie does in certain areas see a significant positive role for government. He's not reflexively anti-government in all cases. But the difficulty has been that Here's a case where he either didn't know what his staff was doing, and that raises questions about how good his oversight is. And, you know, the old line is it's not your enemies who get you into trouble, it's your friends who get you into trouble. Or he did know what they were doing, and that makes it even worse. So he's caught in a difficult position.
Mm-hmm. I guess behind the Darling comment was the idea that the hope that a Chris Christie candidacy could win over Democrats, but also independents in blue states, sort of a key to unlock a magic door,
right,
if you will.
But you see, for a big segment of the Republican Party, especially the more southern and populist dimension of the party, any Republican candidate who can win an election in a blue state with support from Democrats is inherently suspect.
Tim Hagel, what are the most important questions you have on your mind yet to be answered in the Chris Christie controversies?
Well, given that we're in studio together, you could see me smiling when Dennis was talking because I'm just amazed that he thinks that we should be talking about actual policy and issue positions here when most of it seems to be more about perceptions and all of that kind of stuff. And it'd be nice, actually, if we could get back and talk about, well, okay, here are issue positions. But, you know, clearly when something like this comes up that there are questions, and it is a legitimate question to talk about abuse of power and managerial skills, and that's the managerial skills was something that Christie had been proud of. But, you know, it happens. And certainly it happens the bigger the government, the more likely it is to happen, where people that are working for you kind of go off on their own to a certain extent. And one of the things that you sometimes find, particularly for political appointees, is that they will sometimes work to protect the principal, as it's called, that you sometimes don't tell the candidate, the office holder, things that are going on as to sort of the plausible deniability, as it's called. And so they may say, okay, to handle this, don't tell me the details. Now, the candidate's not going to say that quite that bluntly, but the staffer will sort of take that position, saying, okay, I've handled this, or I'm going to do this kind of a thing. And so they do kind of go off the reservation, so to speak. Some of the other scandals, the thing with the audit, that was apparently routine and nothing's really come of that. We'll have to wait and see if anything comes about the Sandy relief money, because Hoboken and some of the other cities did get money. They just didn't get as much as they wanted to. And so at this point, it may be a political piling on. But what's interesting about that, and I was thinking about this as Dennis was kind of laying out some of the Republican concerns with Christie, is that a lot of these criticisms now aren't necessarily coming from Republicans, although some Republicans are probably secretly happy that Christie is being taken down a peg, so to speak. But we'll kind of have to wait and see how this plays out, and if maybe it's a way to sort of kind of hurt, if it is a Democratic payback kind of a thing. Let's see if this hurts Christie in the long run in terms of his chances. And, you know, we'd seen some polls where he was polling ahead of Hillary Clinton, if she's supposed to be the inevitable nominee. Your original question talking about Cuccinelli, he lost his governor's bid. If he had won and was a sitting governor, his thought that Christie should step down as the chair of the RGA might carry more weight. But I think at this point, not so much.
Mm-hmm. We're seeing some of the latest polls, I think Pew, showing that though Christie's unfavorable rating has doubled since
climbed,
last
sure.
has climbed. Do you see a way for him, Chris Christie, to climb out of this controversy, Dennis Goldford? What would be the best scenario you could imagine for him at this point?
Well, you know, I thought the initial press conference was actually quite good. It was an attempt to demonstrate leadership. He immediately severed ties with one of the aides and cut back the duties of the other one he kept on. Things happen, no matter whether you're in executive leadership, in a government, in a corporation, in a university, in a public radio station, whatever. Things happen. And the question, of course, is how do you deal with these issues? And he seemed to deal directly and forcefully with this. But the whole question is that as people who look very carefully at what he said in terms of various issues that he brought up and concerns, he seemed to say some quite distinct and definite things, which lays out some markers. And if all of them stay true, then he could well get past this. But if anything seems not to work out the way he claimed it should, or is the case that he said was not the case, then he's got a big problem. But there have been sharks in the water around Christie, especially on the Republican side, and there's blood in the water now, and that's the question that he'll have to deal with.
Let's go to our callers, 1-866-780-9100. Dennis Goldford and Tim Hagel with us on this Politics Wednesday on River to River. Troy is joining us from Iowa City. Troy dialed 1-866-780-9100. Troy, what's on your mind politically today?
My wondering is will Jesse Ventura run as a Republican or a Democrat?
I haven't heard much about that. Let's see. Tim or Dennis, have you heard about Jesse Ventura?
Not since he left the governor's office.
No, I haven't either, although I can't imagine that he would run from either party, given that he had, at least in the past, had been so disgusted with both of them, and that's why he had run under the old Reform Party back in the day to be the governor of Minnesota. Now, he may, if he's emphasizing different issues, maybe he's going to join one of the two parties to push a particular issue. But I don't know that he would have much of a chance, at least at national level.
Okay, thanks, Troy, in Iowa City. Molly in Scott County. Hi, Molly. I see on my screen you went to a caucus last night.
Yes, I did. I went to our caucus here in Scott County, and we had between 200 and 300 people there. I've been active in our democratic process since I was 18, so that's been over 30 years ago, more than that. And we heard from our 2nd District Congressman, Dave Lobsack, and several of our state representatives, like Cindy Winkler and Jim Lycum, and our local officials also. And it was really a charged event. It was wonderfully charged. We had a lot of nomination papers that were there for those running for office again. And we concentrate a lot on starting to get out the vote because our absentee ballots are extremely important. And we like to, you know, make sure that those that can't get out on election day, like elderly, maybe some veterans, we always like to make sure we get them registered to vote and get an absentee ballot to them. But I had a question. There was a comment made earlier about the Democrats have not done their generational shift as the Republicans have. I'm not certain if I understood that right. Do you mean the Democrats don't have young people in elected offices, or we don't have young people at the grassroots level?
Okay. I think that was Dennis's remark.
Right.
Dennis, explain that. Yeah.
I was referring to the presidential level. Certainly the Democrats have a whole series of a whole number of young people in various elected positions and active in the party. But when you're talking about Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden, for example, you're talking about another generation. I mean, they're both significantly older than Barack Obama is at the moment. Obama was somewhat of a generational shift. O'Malley would be a generational shift. But once we got past John McCain and to some extent past Mitt Romney in the Republican Party, you're talking about possible candidates really tending to be in their 40s more or less. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats, again, we don't know who the likely candidates would be at this point, but they haven't completed that shift yet.
Molly, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. And I would just like to also ask it that you have more women on your round table.
Okay. Well, if you have any names to suggest to us, please get in touch with Iowa Public Radio. Thank you, Molly.
Thank you.
All right. 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about a couple of things not having to do with what we previously talked about. We're in the midst of a public comment period on the EPA's announcement that it would cut the renewable fuel standard. So instead of increasing the amount of gasoline blended with ethanol next year, it would cut the amount of ethanol in the fuel supply by 3 billion gallons. It's a huge issue for Iowa's economy, obviously, and an event previewing the legislative session at one of these events. Governor Terry Branstad said he and all of Iowa's political leaders would be voicing their concerns about the change.
And as the governor of the leading agricultural, the leading corn-producing state, the leading soybean-producing state, you bet I'm going to fight for it. We've got every member of our congressional delegation, all 4 congressmen, both senators, the Secretary of Agriculture, the Lieutenant Governor, and I, we want the entire legislature on board on that as well. And we want to make it clear to anybody that's looking at national office, this is an issue that Iowans care deeply about. And this is an issue that could take the Midwest from leading the nation's recovery into a tailspin.
Mm-hmm. Governor Branstad mentioned there, Tim Hagel, that he's bending the ears of anyone seeking national office. But is anyone seeking national office making these decisions, or do we have any pull here? to get a revision of this decision?
Only to the extent that people are looking forward to future presidential elections and so forth. And, you know, obviously because we're Iowa and we have the First in the Nation caucuses, that this issue does get more play. Famously, John McCain didn't campaign here in 2000 and then again in 2008 because he was against ethanol subsidies and he figured he couldn't, you know, sway any Iowa voters if he were against them. 2012, it didn't seem to be a big issue. But to the extent that this is important to the Iowa economy, it's not surprising that regardless of party, Republican or Democrat, that people are going to want to make sure that Iowa's economy keeps on an upswing and is not going to, you know, falter or stumble because all of a sudden there are going to be cuts in corn prices or what have you. And it's not just the farmers that benefit from this too, because you've got plants that are, you know, producing ethanol and other sorts of things, and so that it employs beyond that the purely farm market.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that? The politics of a renewable fuel, Dennis Goldford?
I don't want to tiptoe around it, but you know, we've got a difficult issue here because certainly during the presidential caucus time, when I get to talk to a lot of people, as I'm sure Tim does, from out of state, so many of them dismiss Iowa's role in the caucus as simply as Iowa's chance to blackmail the rest of the country regarding ethanol. And I say, well, ethanol directly doesn't play that big of a role in the caucuses, at least except at the margins, although the margins can be important. But you know, what you heard the governor doing, and I don't know the science behind all this, but you know, you could ask a question scientifically: is in terms of the national interest, is this kind of this ethanol blend important to do because it's the right thing to do, or, and this is what you get from out of state, is the governor and his Iowa acting simply as an interest group trying to maximize returns and economic well-being for its members? And that's the way that plays to a lot of people from out of state.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add one more thing to there, I'm glad you brought that particular point up, because one of the things that I often think about is that this is sometimes used as an issue, as a convenient issue for the out-of-state people to find another way to attack Iowa. That
right,
you get because
right.
of the caucuses, people don't like us regardless. And so, you know, even if ethanol was off the table, they would still find some reason to dislike Iowa.
Right.
And so the ethanol issue is just a convenient one, I think, that a lot of them hang their hat on.
President Obama announced a new initiative earlier this month to address poverty in the U.S. We also had a study published, a new one by Oxfam. They hit much of the mainstream media. Just 1% of the world's population controls nearly half of the planet's wealth. In the U.S., according to this Oxfam study, the gap between rich and poor has grown at a faster rate than any other developed country, with the top 1% capturing 95% of the post-recession growth since 2009. While 90% of Americans have become poorer. That, again, according to this new study published by Oxfam. Back to the president's initiative to establish so-called promise zones in five economically hard-hit areas of the country. The announcement coincided with the 50th anniversary of President Johnson's, LBJ's, declaration of his war on poverty.
It's now been 50 years since President Johnson declared an unconditional war on poverty in America. And that groundbreaking effort created new avenues of opportunity for generations of Americans. It strengthened our safety net for working families and seniors, Americans with disabilities, and the poor, so that when we fall, and you never know what life brings you, we can bounce back faster. It made us a better country and a stronger country. In a speech 50 years ago, President Johnson talked about communities on the outskirts of hope, where opportunity was hard to come by. Well, today's economic challenges are different, but they've still resulted in communities where, in recent decades, wrenching economic change has made opportunity harder and harder to come by. There are communities where, for too many young people, it feels like their future only extends to the next street corner or the outskirts of town. Too many communities where, no matter how hard you work, your destiny's feels like it's already been determined for you before you took that first step. Now, that's the stereotype. I'm talking about suburban neighborhoods that have been hammered by the housing crisis. I'm talking about manufacturing towns that still haven't recovered after the local plant shut down and jobs dried up. There are islands of rural America where jobs are scarce. They were scarce even before the recession hit, so that young people feel like if they want to actually succeed, they've got to leave town. They've got to leave their communities.
Okay, not much time left there. The president speaking about poverty in our country. Dennis Goldford, not much time left. What could you say about what can be done about this? Why is the president have this poverty agenda?
Well, he thinks it's a winning issue for himself and for Democrats. So there's certainly the political dimension to that. But, you know, the President Johnson, as part of the Great Society, may have declared war on poverty 50 years ago. But for at least 40 years, Republicans and conservatives have said if there's a war on poverty, then poverty won. And if you look at the poverty rate, average it out to accommodate recessions and things like that, really it's not that different from what it was 50 years ago, although seniors have benefited very much from Social Security and especially Medicare. So there's less poverty among the elderly. But the key question really, and it was floating around inside the president's remarks, is not simply absolute inequalities between wealthy and poor. It's whether, in fact, this kind of inequality of income and wealth is having a damaging effect on equality of opportunity. All Americans subscribe to the idea of equality of opportunity.
Just a few seconds left. A quick word, I mean very quick, from each of you about the State of the Union address next week from the president. What are you expecting?
You know, I would say that we'll probably see him talking more about this, the continuing war on poverty, promise zones, and so forth. And Republicans probably see that as an opportunity for the president to spend more money that we don't have.
Okay. Dennis, your expectations?
Republicans will, and to some extent Democrats will ignore everything that's said the day after.
Oh, maybe you might have a sure bet there, Dennis Goldford, as a lame duck president. Well, Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Always a pleasure to have your analysis and your humor on our program. Thank you, gentlemen.
Welcome.
Sure.
River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. Tomorrow on this program, broadcast journalist Soledad O'Brien. She's in Iowa for a lecture on diversity and the media. Tomorrow on River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.